I'm Sharon Stone. This is Engage. When life gets harder to afford, it's a natural reaction to look at government and ask, what exactly do you plan to do to fix it? We put together a panel looking at what government can actually do about the cost of living. Last week, I moderated a conversation at Vote Your Budget, part of Central Florida Public Media's Seen and Heard series in partnership with the Oviedo Community News. We're bringing you that conversation today. A recent Stetson University survey found that 39% of likely Florida voters said the cost of living and inflation is the most important issue in the 2026 election, more than any other issue that was tested. As Judith mentioned, affordability is a major, major talking point in all those campaign ads. Every candidate is promising to make things more affordable for you. Tonight, I want to know, what does that really mean? The goal of this discussion is to talk about that and connect the dots and figure out which parts of that affordability problem are actually affected by public policy and how do you evaluate what a candidate is telling you about how they're going to fix it. So we've assembled this panel this evening to help us understand what government can actually influence, the trade-offs, and how to evaluate those campaign promises. Let's introduce you. Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic state representative who served in the Florida House. He is president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group consulting firm. Next to him, Steve Maceda, director of UCF's Lou Fry Institute in the School of Politics, Security, and International Affairs, where he focuses on civics education and civic engagement. Last but not least, Jeff Randis is a former Republican state senator, also served in the Florida Senate and House. He is a founder and president of the nonprofit Florida Policy Project nonpartisan organization. So thank you all for being here tonight. All right. So when people say that their paycheck isn't keeping up with their lives, part of what they're describing is that a higher wage doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get ahead, that you can afford more, that you can buy more. So Dick, I want to start with you. When you look at the biggest pressures that families face right now, I don't know if it's housing, childcare, transportation. What do families need to understand about what is actually driving those costs for them?
Lots of factors. I mean, we can start at the federal level and talk about inflation and where it is now. We can talk about mortgage rates and where they are now. But also, you mentioned affordable housing. As you know, a great deal of our population workforce is employed by the tourism industry. And the pay rates there are not sufficient enough for a family of four with a combined revenue of $70,000 to be able to afford these apartments. The apartments now are going for like a $2,200 a month for a single bedroom, maybe $2,800 for a two-bedroom apartment. And so they're having to carry a burden of having to work two jobs, number one. Number two, we know what the price of fuel has been doing. It's I've been told it was down, but down from $5 is not down. I paid $5.43 the other day for a gallon of gas. Obviously, that's a big cost for people. Healthcare on a national level is a big burden to people because of the ever-increasing cost of healthcare. But then at the state level, insurance is a tremendous cost. It's a burden that keeps going up. The legislature, in my opinion, has not responded sufficiently to that. They did give $2 billion to the industry over the last 4 years, almost supplementing the private sector, which is interesting, rather than forcing them to get the rates down. So, I mean, all of those factors add up. And when you get up in the morning or get by the kitchen table at night with the checkbook out and try to pay these bills that are all inflated, nothing's going down. The salaries aren't going up. If they do, there are minimal increases. And so it's eaten up by the inflation, gas costs, housing costs, insurance costs, state insurance costs, too. So there are a lot of factors in there.
I want to look at just how much that is something government can actually do something about. Jeff, I want to go to you. Let's break some of those down one at a time. I think the first one that Dick mentioned was housing. Where can the government actually make a difference on something like housing?
Well, the number one way they can do it is to allow for smaller lots. major problems that we have in Florida and specifically Orlando is that the lot sizes are too big. Traditionally, lot sizes have been 20% of the value of a home. Today, they're approaching 30, 40% of the value of a home. And so if, as you shrink lot sizes or allow for extra density on homes or allow for accessory dwelling units, largely those are local decisions. Those aren't state decisions. Everybody likes to talk. I'm sure you, when you're in legislature, remember the Sadowski Trust Fund.
I can remember that far back.
Right.
A long time ago.
So the Florida has this trust fund for affordable housing. It sounds like it's got a lot of money. They put $100 or $200 million in it. But, you know, go divide $200 million by 67 counties and say, how much are you going to buy in each county for $3 or $4 million? Yeah. It doesn't go very far, especially when the cost of constructing a new apartment on an affordable housing basis is probably $250,000 to $300,000 in Central Florida. And so a lot of, at least the housing issues are local level decisions. Those aren't state level decisions. And a lot of it we see are local elected officials who've just chosen not to engage in those types of discussions that allow for less expensive housing, specifically allowing for smaller lot sizes, upzoning, accessory dwelling units, getting rid of parking minimums, those typical things.
Steve, I heard Jeff mentioning lot sizes that's controlled by the local government, but what do you think voters just most misunderstand about who actually has the power to change these things?
I think one of the issues that we face is that I think voters struggle between understanding the difference between a political promise and a political policy. Because just because somebody promises to lower housing prices doesn't mean they're actually able to implement the policy. They don't understand, you know, the questions they need to ask. What is the actual policy that's being proposed, right? What authority does the government even have to do this? They might say that they can do something, but is it aligned with the Constitution, either the state constitution, the federal constitution? You know, is this something a local government should be doing, or is it a state or a federal issue? Who's going to administer the policy? How are you going to actually lower housing prices? You know, the senator talked about a private focus, about changing regulations and laws, and that's something that can be done. But simply saying, I want to change this regulation, people want to hear something that's a little more exciting, right? That's going to catch the news, catch the press, be a soundbite. And I think we struggle with understanding the difference between policy and promises, right? A campaign promise will tell us what someone says they want to accomplish. But again, I think civic literacy comes into play when it can help us understand whether or not they can actually implement what they're promising through that policy.
I think that some issues are more obvious than others. If someone has a problem with a pothole, okay, this can be local, maybe immigration, okay, federal.
But you're making an assumption there that people actually understand that, honestly.
Yeah.
Because people will still call their local congressman to complain about a pothole.
Really? Okay.
Honestly. I mean, that's what the research shows. We've got the general research on civic education and civic knowledge. People do not understand the difference between local, state, and federal government. Again, people looking at... I just want to use an example of the Department of Education, right? The Federal Department of Education. There's a big concern over the federal government shutting down the Department of Education. Well, where does most action happen for education? It happens at the state level, not the federal level. And in some cases at the local level. So we struggle even with smaller issues to differentiate between local, state, and federal, and who can actually do these things. And at the Institute, one of the things we do try to do is educate folks on who does what at different levels of government.
Right.
What would your advice be to just the average voter to try to sort that out?
Again, it sounds simple, but educate themselves. Don't rely on political promises, but also the internet is a problematic for many reasons, but the internet actually can give us correct answers. Don't rely on AI. But the internet can give us correct answers on where we actually find things. Your local, whether it's Seminole County or Orange County, websites will tell you who does what and who can control what organization, what part of government actually will do some of these things. But you have to actually make the effort to actually do so and not just complain about it.
You know, I would say that public education obviously is a major issue in most people. But again, the legislature has cut about $2 billion out of public education and gone to a voucher system. And so, again, I think that's one of those local issues, particularly with parents with children in public school or private school, to understand that, too, because they're depleting resources in the public education arena.
I want to open up this one to whoever is willing to respond. I've heard very little about health insurance during this primary election season. Any thoughts on why that is?
Well, I think, at least in this state, the focus has been primarily on property taxes, mm-hmm. right? We have Amendment 3, which is currently being addressed or litigated, fought over. So there's less concern, I think, over health insurance. And again, I'm not taking a particular position on anything. I want to be clear on this. But I think that the Affordable Care Act has had a somewhat positive impact on ensuring folks have some access to insurance. And I come from a family that is very much in need of medical insurance. My wife's sitting in the crowd there. But I think really it's less of a concern, perhaps, because of the focus on property taxes over anything else. But, you know, if that gets settled, it could end up being an issue in 2 years.
May I follow up on that?
Of course.
Steve mentioned Amendment 3. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
The elephant in the room, so to speak, right? The proposed constitutional amendment, which requires 60% plus to pass, in my opinion, is an extraordinarily bad public policy. Why they want to do a constitutional amendment to cut property taxes, you know, by increasing your exemptions substantially over a two-year period of time. If you look at that, it's going to cost local governments billions of dollars. In fact, in Orange County, they're going to lose about $152 million the first year alone in revenue. That doesn't include the losses when it comes to providing the ad valorem tax basis for law enforcement, fire and rescue, and et cetera. Philosophically, I would think that a conservative government and a conservative governor would yield to Thomas Jefferson when he said the best governance is local government. You know, let the cities and counties make those fiscal decisions, financial decisions. They are held accountable, at least in most cases, by the electors. And so why are you basically interfering? I know the CFO had his Doge reports going around and looking at some expenditures. An example, the city of Orlando spent, I think, $15,000 for a poet laureate. Look, you've got a budget, and Senator, you can tell me how much the state budget is now. It's about...
It's a lot of money.
A lot of money. Lots of money. But why not audit your own state agencies? Let the local governments be responsible to the people who are locally elect them to make those decisions that impact government and impact their assessments. And then the state, in fact, when I was in the legislature, which was a long time ago, I chaired a number of committees. One was the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. We used to do zero-based budgeting of every state agency. I can guarantee you that you can go into any state agency and cut that agency's budget by 5%. Without even blinking. And then we're talking about real money at that point in time. So anyway, so I would encourage you to really educate yourself on this amendment and the impact it's going to have on local government. I know even local law enforcement agencies have come out against it. Fire and Rescue has come out against it. Even Sheriff Judd in Polk County says he's opposed to it. So there seems to be building opposition to it, but if the polls, and I don't trust polls this far out anyway, indicate that it could pass, the likelihood it would pass, but I think there has not been a sufficient public education and public discussion about the impact of that constitutional amendment on local government, because the last point I make is if you cut those budgets locally that significantly with the ad valorem tax amendment, they're going to have to make it up someplace else. So it's really a shift in burden or on tax burden. It's not a net cut in budgets.
Jeff, I could tell you were adjusting the microphone and you're ready.
You're not wrong. Look, Amendment 3 is a tax shift. It's not a tax cut. Communities have to pay these bills. They're simply going to shift to non-ad valorem fees. Non-ad valorem fees are not subject to exemptions. So you're going to get a fire fee. You're going to get a stormwater fee. You're going to get a wastewater fee. Your tax bill is going to start looking like a ticket on Spirit Airlines, where everything's, you know, a separate charge, a separate cost. Yeah. And a lot of those are not subject to exemptions. There's some weird things that are about to happen. For example, long-term property owners may end up finding out that their taxes went up after this because the non-ad valorem is actually greater than what their exemption is. Mm. And so there are some interesting things there. We had a conversation about affordable housing. If this exemption is $250, what's the incentive for a city or county to allow a $250,000 house? Because now it's only a cost to them, not to, there's no benefit to the community. There's only a cost to the community going forward. So I think there's a lot of, you know, cities and counties are the governor's already said he's going to have to bankrupt some of these cities and counties. So we need to create a trust fund. But I will tell you, once Tallahassee starts paying the bills, they start making the rules. And that's like a children with an allowance. That's what's going to happen. And so this is where this plays out. This is an amendment that was put on without people thinking about it, without the numbers. We know they didn't have the numbers when they did that because the numbers didn't come out until 2 months after they actually put the amendment together. And the whole point of this is nobody wants to talk about it because the polling shows that the more people know, the less they like. And so if they don't talk about it, then nobody will ask questions. They'll get into the ballot box, potentially just see the first line, which is, you know, the big flashy numbers, and not thinking through the deeper issues. Now, we'll see if, you know, a lot of people say we just trust voters and they'll do the right thing. And this is a complicated issue with multiple facets to it. I understand most legislators didn't understand what they were voting on. I hope the public will take some time and pause and think about the consequences.
And I think they made this decision in a 27-hour session.
Yeah,
it was a proposed constitutional amendment, and as you alluded to, as you mentioned, they did it without a fiscal impact statement attached to it. And now, as you know, the courts have ruled against the language in the ballot, and the Attorney General is now having to rewrite the language so it's more neutral, if I might use that term.
It looks now like the attorneys have taken over instead of the politicians, and it reads like the attorneys wrote it. But people just need to think through the consequences of what it does and how it plays out and the ripple effects. This isn't just, hey, we get a big exemption. It's we get an exemption. And then every year after 2029, it adds via inflation to that exemption. Of course, your city's costs go up with inflation. So the cities end up getting squeezed in the middle here. And there are going to be cities and counties that don't survive this. The simple truth is that happens. And so We get into the situation of orphan counties and orphan cities. I think you'll see some orphan counties too, but what happens to the city nobody wants because of its pension liabilities, because of its roads and infrastructure costs? Now all of a sudden the county has to assume that, but they don't want it. So the law guarantees you a government. It doesn't guarantee that you may like that government. It doesn't guarantee that you will keep that government, that same government. Because largely what cities and counties are going to do, or counties are going to do to cities that dissolve, is they're going to create a special taxing district around that city, and they're going to charge all of the people that live within that former city higher fees to cover those costs so they're not covered by the rest of the county. You can see this playing out, right? The ripple effects of this are pretty substantial.
I think you both really touched on an issue we see. Again, we talked about public education, is that citizens don't understand where their tax dollars are going. Mm-hmm. They don't understand how much of their property tax goes to covering fire and roads. I was in a discussion with someone. We were talking about roads, and they said, well, why should I have to pay for the road? What do you mean, why do you have to pay for the road? you want to drive on it? You don't want to drive over potholes. So I think we need to do a better job, and the state has implemented personal financial literacy efforts, but I'm not sure they go that far, in educating citizens on where exactly our taxes are actually going. It's not just all going to one thing or another. And, you know, it's going to, as you guys have both said, it's going to lead to hidden costs that aren't going to be so hidden pretty soon. And, you know, nobody likes flying Spirit Airlines. I don't want to have my tax bill look like a Spirit airline, right?
Didn't work out well for Spirit.
Yeah.
No, I think what people don't understand is, you know, city and county budgets, they aren't buckets of money. Yeah. They're more like ice trays. Right. Where you can't spend money out of different pieces. Like you can't take grant money that you get from the state or federal government and spend it outside that grant. You have a whole pocket of funds that are just enterprise funds. So it's your sewer, your water, sometimes they have electrical, airports are enterprise funds. And so you see these huge numbers. You're like, oh, my county has $1 billion budget and this is only going to take $30 million from them. They've got plenty of money left. But what they don't realize is that you actually have to look beyond just the county budget to look specifically at the part of the ice trade as that is the general fund. And then from that general fund, you have to back out its pension obligations, its bonded debt, its contractual obligations, its police, its firefighters. And what you realize is city councils and county commissions actually don't manage that much of money that they really have discretion on. And what we're mostly arguing about is the little tiddly expenses of their discretionary funds. But ultimately, that's not what makes up a majority of these budgets. And many of these groups are really struggling. This is why police and firefighters are struggling so much, Because for some of these special districts, you're going to see 50% cuts. Mm. And the county and cities are going to have to make some significant shifts.
The cost of living is a top concern for voters. We continue our conversation about what government can and can't do about it, and how to evaluate all those candidate campaign promises. Jeff Brandis is a former Republican state senator. He's the founder and president of the Florida Policy Project nonpartisan organization. Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic state representative who served in the Florida House. He's president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group consulting firm. Steve Maceda is director of UCF's Lou Fry Institute in the School of Politics, Security, and International Affairs, where he focuses on civics education and civic engagement.
Steve, I need to ask you a question just on behalf of the average citizen. You're sitting between two people on opposite sides of the aisle. Some of what they're bringing up are unintended consequences of a policy that might sound good. How is a voter supposed to think about unintended consequences before a policy is put in place?
Well, they actually have to be willing to think about those unintended consequences to begin with. They want to hear only the promises, not the costs. And so, again, it's where the research comes into play. But we also need to actually be able and be willing to talk about those negatives in such a way that we're not yelling at each other. You know, both of these men are on opposite sides of the aisle. But as you can see, they have some shared sentiments. And I think we've reached a point where we struggle to actually see that we all have the same idea, and that's we care about our state and we care about our nation.
Dick or Jeff, Steve brought up the point that there has to be a willingness to be educated. Do you think this is an issue of being willing? I think you could argue that some people are just trying to get through life and do the best they can.
Well, sure, but your listeners are listening to public radio. They're the ones that are listening to a podcast of two former legislators, you know, the two old Muppets sitting at the top of the Muppets commenting on the current Muppet show going on before us. They're probably slightly more engaged than most people on these types of topics. So I think we're a little bit like we're preaching to the choir here, and they typically are a little bit more engaged. So there's probably some selection bias with the audience that you actually have. But I think the point is well made, right? We talked a little bit about people not knowing what level of government to interact with. I think it starts there. I remember my kids were telling me the other day, they're like, Dad, we're so happy we got an A on this test on civics. The only reason that we got the A was because, like, we lived basically in the Senate with you for years. Right? It wasn't the things we learned. It was just like we understood the three branches of government. We understood how this all plays out. It made sense. But most people don't have that experience, and it shouldn't take that. This stuff is complicated, and I think that's just because government does too much. It does so much in people's lives, and the more it does, the more complicated it gets. It just consistently grows like a big blob into our lives, and it gets more complicated every day, and that's a challenge, and somebody has to sort through all that.
I think it was Jefferson also who said what the government can do for you, it can do to you.
Sure, of course.
And so I think that, again, it gets back to it. So, and I think people not being willing to go so far on some issues, but they're, again, they're almost like, you know, I'm just frustrated. Do something different. In fact, I saw one poll where it basically said the Trump administration is at 36% popularity rate, if that's a popularity. But Democrats are only at 40%. So they're frustrated not with the administration alone, not with just Republicans, but they're also frustrated with Democrats because you're not making it work for me. So that whole cynicism that's inbred out there, but the only way, in my opinion, the final note, that you can mitigate against that is for people to be engaged, understand the process, be involved in the process, so that if they feel comfortable, they can petition to go down to the senator. You had to do a lot of constituent work. Mm-hmm. So when people go to the senator and he can help make government work for them, whether it's go to an agency and say, you're not doing this right, you're not treating my constituents right. So that whole thing, I think, is if we can enlist people, convince them that government can function, most important, convince them they can petition their government and the government be responsive, yeah, I think that will go a long way. Because right now, I know we talked about social media and AI, alluded to it. I saw a T-shirt the other day, it said AI in big letters, but you get closer, it says actual intelligence. So we need to deal with actual intelligence when it comes to the voting process.
I
think your point is well made, because everybody loves their congressman but hates Congress.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that's the challenge that we run into, is that when these organizations kind of start the groupthink, and we've both served in Tallahassee, so we've seen the groupthink take over, right? And oftentimes I think Amendment 3 was a lot of groupthink, or at least leadership led, and that creates a lot of challenges.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you mentioned, Dick, the polling, right, either for the administration or for the parties. And I think we need to look deeper into that polling and look at the generational divide, because older voters generally are a little better off and feel a little better about government than kids like my daughter, generation, you know, Gen Z, right?
Gen Z.
Because they don't see government doing anything for them. And they get accused of spending money on avocado sandwiches. Right. Well, why don't you save that money, put it towards a house? You guys have both already talked about the cost of housing. Mm-hmm. And right, me buying an avocado sandwich is not going to keep me from buying a house. It's everything else. In fact, either my taxes might be too high, my salary might not be high enough, my health insurance, my property taxes are too high. That's what's keeping me from buying a house.
Yeah. I'm still doing Dunkin' Donuts. No Starbucks.
Exactly. And hey, look, you know, I've been in New England, I'm a big fan of Dunkies, so that's good. But I think there's a generational divide there too, whether we're talking economics or we're talking politics.
Yeah.
A couple of follow-ups. First, Dick, how do you literally petition the government to do what's best?
Yeah, I mean, it's really pretty simple. You reach out to them. We used to write letters and have to respond to letters, but it's all emails now. You can email them. But I always encourage you, call and make an appointment. Insist upon an appointment. The one thing that works very well around the state is you have the legislative delegations that will meet, or the legislators in your district will convene before the legislative session. So you can go and speak to 10, 15, 20, probably in Dade County, Senator, probably 35 members of the House and Senate, if not more. But you can actually go and testify there at a public meeting. You only get 2 minutes, though, so I just have to say you got to be fast. But anyway, you can get a group of people and go on the same issue, and each person can talk for 2 minutes. So that's one way to directly approach the legislative delegation. Secondly, follow up with them and ask for a meeting. Don't be intimidated by the process. Mm. I think people are intimidated by the process because if you don't understand it, how it works. But I start with the basics. I have one of the old sayings I love, and I don't know where it came from. Don't go around your wrist to get to your elbow. You know, you can go over here and go to that and go to this. Go straight to the elected officials that you support or are being asked to support, and the candidates, and petition them directly. Don't have to be intimidated. You don't have to get in your car and drive 4 hours to Tallahassee or anything like that. You can actually petition them directly. So you might have to assert yourself a little bit, but get with the aides. The aides are very, very important, by the way, just as a poli-sci 101. And you've got to get to those aides, because those aides can help facilitate these meetings for you. So encourage it. And also civic, whether it's the League of Women Voters, whether it's the Rotary Club, or whatever it might be, any kind of forum where you can be educated and have influence, it can enhance your credibility, your borrowed interest when you go in. It's not just you. You might be going in on behalf of an organization. But don't be intimidated by the process, and also petition them directly.
Dick brought up just frustration as to what actually motivates someone to go from being frustrated about an issue to doing something about it.
And again, if you look at the polling and you look at the data and the research, it's something that immediately and directly impacts them. And again, I'm not taking a position on anything. I like my job.
You sound like a candidate now. I'm not taking a position
right,
on
exactly.
anything.
But for example, you look at the issue of gay marriage. What often converts somebody on that particular issue is they have a family member who is queer, right? And so in many cases, it's the immediate impact on their lives that's gonna cause them to take that next step. But also, I think that education is important. They need to know how to begin that process. And again, that's where schools come into play. Students have to have the opportunity to engage with their political leaders and their local officials. Now, again, teachers know that should know their place, that they're not supposed to encourage their students to take a position, but students should be able to understand how to engage with their political leaders. And Florida actually is really good about that because we do allow students to engage with local officials, government officials. Some states have actually made it illegal for students to engage with political leaders. They are not allowed to write letters to congressmen, for example, as a classroom activity. But we need to be able to encourage them to do that because they have to understand their rights, but not just their rights, their responsibilities as citizens. Because if we don't know our responsibilities, we have just as out of time as in solving these problems as well.
Jeff and Dick, you've both been elected to serve in government. Can you just peel back the curtain a little bit? I want to know about how actually government works. And give me an example of a promise you made campaigning and how you work to actually get it done.
Do you want me to start?
I mean, absolutely.
Once you figure out how government works, let me know. I was there for 12 years, and it's still a mystery. It wrapped in an enigma to me. So, I think it shifts. I think it changes. I think government changes consistently. And ideas are often closed. Like, you can have the best idea in the world in Tallahassee, and the window for that idea may be closed for years. But you better be ready when it opens. Mm. I remember an amendment that I filed on some piece of legislation, and the window for that amendment was 30 seconds all year long. There was only one time where that bill was in that posture with everything ready, and I had been ready for days for that 30-second window to file that amendment to get that issue through. And there are literally thousands of issues that are kind of waiting to. You know, most bills in Tallahassee die, vast majority of them die. And the other strange thing that people don't recognize is the vast majority of them are bipartisan, right? 80-90% of the bills that pass in Tallahassee are bipartisan. We aren't fighting on, you know, most issues. So most issues are not a major substantial issues. They're hey, you know, most people aren't fighting on transportation. Most people aren't fighting on the prison system. Well, vast majority of these issues they aren't fighting on. They're fighting on a handful of small things. But it allows most legislators in Tallahassee to get along actually very, very well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so different than Congress, and Tallahassee is not Congress. The feeling is totally different, and the collegiality is very different. And frankly, most of them go in with the right intentions. Mm-hmm. I think most of them are, like every other profession, 90% of the work is done by about 10% of the people.
Yeah.
I think the number one superpower of a legislator is curiosity.
Ooh,
and most of them just aren't that curious.
Interesting. Right. Was the process harder than you thought it was going to be? Was there more give and take, having to make compromise?
Have you seen the first movie of The Matrix? You ever seen the movie The Matrix? I'm sure you all have seen The Matrix, right?
I'm curious where this is going.
First decision is what, red pill, blue pill? And then you wake up and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm in The Matrix. And then you learn all of these skills that are really only valuable in The Matrix. And then what happens at the end of the movie? You can dodge bullets. You see the zeros and ones of the process. And that's a lot like being in the Florida legislature.
Interesting.
You, by the end of the process, by the end of your time there, you can dodge bullets. You know what's about to happen before things happen. I'm sure you saw this, right?
Yeah,
by the time you were a senior, and somebody comes to you with an idea and you're like, that's never going to happen. Let me just stop you right now.
Yeah.
This isn't going to work.
Yeah.
And let me tell you why. And you can go through the five permutations of all of the ways that that bill would die off or that amendment would get killed. So I think it's a little bit like that. And the beauty of being a former legislator is you've been through that movie before. You're at the end. You've seen the zeros and ones. And if you have the curiosity to stay in the conversation, I think you can be a benefit to your community for decades.
Well, I didn't see The Matrix back in my day, as they say, but they weren't all in black and white. I'm not that old anyway, just not that old. When I returned from Vietnam, I was the Marines and served a tour there. I got involved in politics, and my first thing I did is I went to Tallahassee and lobbied for the 18-year-old vote. Mm-hmm. You know, I figured I could make a good argument. If I'm 18 years old, I'm in during the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, but I can't vote. You know, so I got involved early on, but I co-sponsored the Equal Rights Amendment. I was only legislator in Orange County to support that, but I kept getting reelected, I guess. I did. But One of the things I did, just an anecdote, I filed a bill, and I'll sit up here, you'll appreciate this. I filed a bill in 1974 that would increase the amount of marijuana you could possess, but and decrease the penalty. Because we were actually, and it was not a legalization of marijuana, but I knew they were going to say that and use it against me in my campaign. But it was basically, we were putting 18-year-old kids in jail for possession with the assumption that you were trafficking because you had too much marijuana with you. And people thought I was crazier than Hades, right? Mm-hmm. I'm filing, this is 1974, right? But I survived that too. My campaign opponent did take out ads and said I was for the legalization of marijuana, but fortunately, I took her to court, and she had to take the ads down and won. But I want to make one final point as far as Steve alluded to, spoke to the whole thing about the Gen Z population. But does that, we get back to that attitude about government. Often, office holders are responsible for that cynicism because you're just yelling at each other. You're yelling past each other, extreme left, extreme right. And there's so many negative campaigns. And you used to run on issues, right? But now it's really very difficult campaigns. One final example in the closing is there's a senator in the state who's running for Congress who's gay. There's a third party, unannounced, violating state law and federal law by sending out Twitters about the fact that he's gay. I mean, that kind of campaign still goes on. And then you wonder why people are cynical. If you run, you should run on a platform and maybe have these things you want to do that we've talked about tonight, you know, rather than just attacking the person you run against and getting very vicious about it. Because it used to be you could regulate that, but you can't anymore. And it's very vicious. So candidates and some incumbents have, they need to bear some of the responsibility for the cynicism that's out there because there's so much negative stuff. It's just unfortunate, very, very unfortunate. But elected officials and those in public life have a responsibility to try to mitigate that criticism by not doing things that make people cynical.
Did you ever have a moment, like Jeff was talking about, where you look at a candidate making a promise and you're just like, that's not happening?
I'm trying to think. An issue where somebody came to me and said, we want to do X, Y, and Z, and you go,
no, don't even
go away. I can't think of one. I'm sure I gave some advice, but I was so darn young and pliable, I would introduce almost any legislation you asked me to. And back then, you didn't have a limit. You could file all the bills you wanted. Right. You wanted to.
Well, they only had typewriters that slowed everything down.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the Underwood.
Printing presses.
Underwood.
We're concluding the conversation we had at Vote Your Budget, part of Central Florida Public Media's Seen and Heard series, in partnership with the Oviedo Community News. Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic state representative who served in the Florida House. He is president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group consulting firm. Jeff Brandis is a former Republican state senator and founder and president of the Florida Policy Project nonpartisan organization. Steve Maceda is director of UCF's Lou Fry Institute in the School of Politics, Security, and International Affairs, where he focuses on civics education and civic engagement. They were part of our panel discussion about what government can do about the cost of living, the trade-offs, and how to evaluate campaign promises.
Campaign ads certainly make all of this sound a lot easier. Vote for me and I'll fix it. Steve, how should voters evaluate these campaign promises that we've been talking about?
Well, I talked about this at the beginning, really. Don't tell me what you're going to do. Tell me how you're going to do it, right? What is the process you're going to take to lower the price of eggs? And do you have the ability to lower the price of eggs? Because there's nothing in the Constitution that says you have the ability to fix prices, to set prices. And so I think that is where education comes into play. You have to be willing to ask the how, not just the what. Mm-hmm. A promise is not a policy. And I think until we realize that, we're going to continue to struggle with these kitchen sink issues.
Do you have any insight as to how the public views campaign language? Like, is there something that makes a person skeptical of a campaign promise? Or maybe something that makes them say, okay, this is a plan I can get behind?
Well, I mean, there's a whole ton of research on this. I mean, both of these men have ran political campaign ads, I am sure. And they have consultants who tell you, what language do I actually use to get a particular emotion for this? I can't necessarily give you an example off the top of my head, but essentially, voters are more likely to look skeptically at an ad that essentially guarantees a 100% correction to any particular issue. Unfortunately, they're also not likely to respond positively to this idea of nuance.
Yeah, and you're trying to get people's attention, right? I mean, right. That's the whole point of getting is getting people's attention. I ran a campaign ad. You're going to love this. I ran a campaign ad one time against a professor, a PhD, and she had a glove on, and she looked like she was about to give a proctological exam. And she stood up in a debate and said, I'm not even that type of doctor. Right? But I said, you know, but those are the types of, those are the things that get your attention, right? Yeah. You're getting 30 mail pieces. What stands out? I'm trying to stand out of the crowd here. Right. I mean, I wanted my mail pieces so big that it was the last thing in the trash that you pushed down was seeing my face in this thing. Nobody keeps these things. They're all going in the trash within 30 seconds. I have to make an impression like this. You know, and those are the types of things we see, right? So to me, it was less words, bigger pictures, make it funny and interesting, because this is advertising. This is marketing. Ultimately, these people are marketing themselves, and they have to tell the story. The simple truth is 80% of these incumbents are going to get reelected.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, in Congress, it's like 90%, and you know, it's or higher, that they're going to get reelected. They have all of the benefits going for them. They have the name ID. They have the money. They have the relationships with the local public officials. You're swimming upstream to take on an incumbent politician. That's just the simple truth. And for the most part, the promises that, you know, I used to love this. One of the things that you can do in the legislature is you can sponsor bills at the end of session. And then you can claim that you were the sponsor of that bill. Right? And so the strategy is you take a whole list of bills that you think at the end of session will help you at a future campaign. And you immediately go back in and you co-sponsor all of those bills. So then on all of your marketing material, you can claim that you were the sponsor of the legislation. Right. I mean, these are the types of things that we see over and over again. And these are the types of games that get played and that frankly, you just don't see. But the simple truth is you think you select who represents you. And maybe that might be true if they come up through the grassroots and it's organic. But oftentimes you select who the political party puts up. Mm. The political party chooses who you get to select from. The Republicans are going to put their money behind a person. The Democrats are going to put behind the money behind the person. They don't want an expensive, crowded primary. They want to get through the primary, get to the general, and get to the race. Mm-hmm. And so they oftentimes don't split the money. They focus on one candidate that they think has the best name ID to get through. It is the shortest putt. May not be the best candidate. By far. Mm-hmm. And it might be the most likely candidate to win, but absolutely the worst corrupt candidate that you could have. Mm. But they're the ones who are going to support because they're probably going to get elected. Yeah. Because it's for them, it's the shortest putt. So this is the simple truth of politics is it's messy. It's ugly. But it's the best system in the world. All the rest are worse.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So this is the wonderful world we live in.
Yep. If I might inject a little levity here after that, but as a member of the legislature, I'm sure you've done the same thing. When a bill comes for the legislature, you have, of course, a right to offer an amendment to it. And I filed a bill, which was controversial at the time, to allow group homes for people with disabilities to be located in residential communities, limited to 6 people, but still, nevertheless, you could put group homes. They used to put the group homes way out. We had these old institutions for retardation and mental health, and they were warehoused with no treatment. So we wanted group homes, right? Well, a House member objected to it violently and said, if you pass this piece of legislation, crazy people will be running through your neighborhood. So he was mean, and he was personal about his attack. We passed the bill. The next day he had a bill come up. This is Representative Woodruff. I remember Tom very well. The next day he had his own bill come up, and he'd been mean to those people, I thought, on my bill. And so his bill basically said, in the old days, you know, you used to be able to retire and you would keep a license plate on the front of your car from Pennsylvania or Alabama, wherever, and then on the back of the car, you would have a registered license plate for Florida. He filed a bill that the next day that would make it illegal to have any license plate on your car, front or back, from any other state other than Florida. And so I offered an amendment. And his bill said you can't have a license plate in the front of your car or in the back of the car from the state of Florida. And my amendment read, comma, unless you want to. And it passed. Obviously, I killed his bill. But anyway, so I figured he shouldn't have been so mean.
Well, I want to wrap this up, but let me just go down the line. Practical advice, bring this full circle back to where we started, the household budget. I'm sitting here, I'm struggling to afford my life. What is the most useful thing you want me to understand when I walk out of this room about the role public policy plays in my budget?
You need to have the candidates discern for you how they can help, number one. Number two, you need to identify the source that or elected official at the level where they can do things. Let's say the Congress, and you need to petition the members of Congress to respond to your issue.
Basically everything that Dick just said, but also, again, know where your tax dollars are going, know where your money is going.
If any politician comes to you and says they're from the government and they're here to help, they're lying.
Yeah.
Right? Ultimately, you have to be responsible for your own family and your own finances, and the government's not going to save you. Yeah. And whether that be in housing, whether that be in healthcare, whether that be in any issue in the state, for the most part, it will keep you safe. It will protect you. It will make sure that law enforcement shows up and fire departments show up. And that's a responsibility. And it's probably the number one responsibility that we have in government, is to ensure your public safety. Yeah. But beyond that, most other issues, if you're relying on government to solve your problem, you're relying on the wrong thing.
I want to make sure the audience has time to ask questions. They do. Is there anyone who had any questions for the panel?
So my question is to the senator. At the beginning, you were saying that the lot on a property is like 33% of the cost, and that we should make smaller lots to make it more affordable. Now, on the other side of the coin, there's the owners that they don't want more construction, they don't want more properties because their property value is going to come down. So how do you manage that yeah, you do want to increase and have more housing, but yeah, then at the same time, some people, they don't want that because it's going to reduce their value in the property?
Well, I think you know, you have to understand what's going on in Florida right now. I think this is, let's say it this way. What's going on in Florida right now is that the wealthy are doing fine. The wealthy are just, you know, they're paying cash for houses. They're doing fine. High-end condos are selling. High-end homes are selling. No problem. The middle is getting squeezed, right? Think about this. The homes prices in 2019, you could buy a home in Orlando for $250,000. Mm-hmm. And you could have a 5% interest rate on that. And today, if you want to buy that same home, it's going to be $400,000. And you're going to pay 7% interest rate on that, mm-hmm, on that house. That's a totally different world than 200, 250 and you know, 5%. Totally different world. Mm-hmm. But there is nothing at the bottom. Builders aren't building it. Communities aren't wanting it. And we're seeing this play out across the state, where there is the entry-level home has gone extinct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because communities want the tax base, or because exactly what you said. Hey, listen, I don't want a starter home in my community. Well, great. Will you allow a duplex in your community? Would you allow a quad in your community? What about an accessory dwelling unit? Can we turn your garage into a garage apartment? These are all things that add housing stock. And we've got to start thinking about units. We need more units for young families. The simple truth is that we can't stay in a world where this, for the first time home buyer, is 40 years old. Because what we need them to do is start families and have kids, or we're going to be closing schools all across the state of Florida. Why? Because we're just not keeping up with birth rate. Immigration is shut off. Right? There's no immigration coming here. For the most part, we're seeing, you know, as the homes have gotten more expensive, even domestic immigration is down 90%.
Wow.
From where it was during the pandemic. Mm. So things have slowed. And my big concern is this. The thing that keeps me up at night is, who buys all these baby boomer houses? Because every generation behind the baby boomers is smaller. And so when we think about Amendment 3, and this is pull it all together, is what happens when the housing prices over the next 20 years continue a steady decline, inflation continues to rise, and these exemptions continue to come up, and the home prices continue to stay flat or go down? Now all of a sudden, cities and counties get squeezed from three different directions. And this is the major challenge that we face, I think, as a state. And And what I think is not definitely not talked about enough is who buys all the baby boomer houses.
Hmm. That was really well said. I just want to say that was really well said.
Thank you.
Don't take a position.
Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic state representative and founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group consulting firm. Steve Maceda is director of UCF's Lou Fry Institute. Jeff Brandis is a former Republican state senator and founder of the Florida Policy Project. Engage is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Richard Copeland is our senior producer. I'm Sharon Stone. You can reach us anytime with questions, comments, or story ideas. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org. Thanks for listening.